Esperanza.
Mi corazón.
Chicks, you're listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast. This week we are going to talk about The Losers, which opens in Bolivia, hence the music you're hearing.
Ah, I get it now.
I am joined with Christian Malzansky.
I'm going to abandon my previous joke and just say you can just call me Papi.
Also, we have with us today Kelly Wand. Mr. Wand, have you for us a tagline?
Madre Cucucacha es muy luongo.
Okay, that probably is illegal to translate in some states. I can only imagine what that meant.
I didn't know Bolivia was a state.
No, but...
The dead silence. It's like food.
Kelly Wand, why don't you now tell us the plot of The Losers. What happens in this movie?
Hannibal and BA and Face get framed for a crime that they were ordered to commit but didn't because kids. And Zoe Saldana sees Clay, and something about the Genesis device from Star Trek is the MacGuffin. And runway, motorcycle. I just saw this. I didn't really have time to think about it yet. So these are the thoughts I had written down while I was watching the movie. And the writers had when they wrote the movie.
Gotcha. I think that about covers it.
Did I leave anything out?
I hate you guys
for not knowing about The Wire, because Idris Elba was in this.
No, please. You don't have to be a Wire fan to understand Idris Elba's awesomeness. Like, that goes to Ultraviolet. 28 weeks later, by the way. Idris Elba calling Code Red. It's classic stuff.
But not having seen The Wire, you guys are like babies.
He was in The Office.
You can't judge any... that's true. He was playing the same guy. He never plays a British guy. But I'm really offended that you guys haven't seen it yet.
He plays a British guy in Ultraviolet. Hello.
Is that the one with Charlize Theron?
Oh, good lord.
Deus Ex. What's her name?
Aeon Flux.
Oh, yeah.
You're thinking, Kelly Wand, of the one, it's another Aeon Flux thing. It's with Mia Jovovich playing a woman who carries Cameron Bright around in a suitcase.
Right. So he's the one who didn't win the Oscar for playing...
Exactly. Playing a serial killer. No, the Ultraviolet, that where I first ran into Idris Elba, who that's one of the... We'll get back to The Losers in a minute. The Ultraviolet where I first ran into Idris Elba is a British series that was probably inspired by The X-Files, but it's centered strictly around vampires. There's a sort of a Mulder and Scully character, and Idris Elba is one of the guys in it.
Is he the Mulder or the Scully?
He's neither. He is he's the extra badass, like, black dude who's with them. And
That's kind of a reach for Idris Elba. He must be a really good actor. You're right.
Well, and he does.
Right. He is white.
I've never seen him play a bad. Yeah.
And he uses a British accent in this series, so he can do accents, obviously. When you hear him speak with a British accent, you think, oh, he can do that. So, Ultraviolet, great stuff. Idris Elba is in it. I used to be of the opinion that anything with Idris Elba in it has got to be really good, but then I saw The Losers. Disabused of that notion. Let's go around the table. Kelly Wand, is that the sum total of your reaction?
Yeah, but that's pretty good. That's more than I thought I was going to like it. I like some of it. I like little chunks, but it's like they're all the same dude. They're all like droll, and but none of them, they don't say anything that funny. It's like the timing's right, but the lines aren't that great.
You didn't like, I have a crossbow, bitch.
No.
Okay.
But I liked Chris Evans playing the guy who can't get laid. But I didn't like the other guy who got laid all the time, the matador from the right. Hat. And I can't get too excited when I see a Zoe Saldana sex scene developing because I know I'm not going to see much.
Okay.
Because I know it's Zoe Saldana. She's Ms. Big Shot right now.
Okay, so that was your review. Dingus, what? how would you characterize how you felt about the movie?
Is that the right noise?
But I said that with kind of affection.
That's yeah,
Dingus, Dingus can't put affection into that sound.
That's true.
Because he's a father.
That's true.
Dingus, you want to try a different sound, maybe? One that might more accurately capture your reaction to the movie?
All right, how about this?
Wow, you really liked it, because I think that sounded like... I don't even want to say. All right, so you're a huge fan of The Losers, it sounds like.
Either that or I'm sitting on the toilet right now.
Hmm. Spoiler.
I say it's great as a March of the One-Liners kind of a movie.
Except for the actual one-liners per acre.
The one-liners themselves aren't good, but there's a lot of them, and they're all sort of next to each other, and you could really throw almost any line in this movie into the trailer, and it would you could bump up any line in this movie next to any other line, and it's sort of like a Rubik's Cube of one-liners you could throw into a trailer and make all kinds of different movies.
Yeah,
I think the movie constantly nullifies itself, and it's
like Sports Night. Remember that show?
I love Sports Night, so don't you dare.
No, I do too, but it's like any character on that show could have said something witty, and that's kind of how the show or this movie was. It's like they're all the same level of wit.
Yeah, there's some pretty moments. There's some good sort of gunshots.
There's no blood, considering.
No blood, no breasts, unfortunately. They talk about blood and breasts, but
yeah.
Nobody actually shows any of them. I could just talk about all of the different things, but just as my first reaction, I said yeehaw, maybe.
Jason Patrick.
All right, well, then
I'm going to say, Tom, go ahead and put your cards on the table.
Yeah, okay, well, you guys are like pussyfooting around, like,
That's that kind of movie.
All right, well, here's my reaction. Good Lord, I hated this. This was just so, like, dull and rote and derivative and without any charm or energy, and it made me appreciate Kick-Ass, which we saw last week, so much more. I mean, The Losers is just, I don't even call it trash because it's just a non-entity. What a dull, spiritless, just by-the-numbers, routine, forgettable movie. I really was just so down on this.
Does it disgust you at all?
No. Because I don't feel that strongly.
You know what scene totally makes your point, makes me agree with you more the more I think about it, is when Zoe Saldana meets Clay and then they fight, and then it's like she goes, they fight after she goes, I have a business proposition for you.
The movie does it constantly. The movie
just fights with no stakes and no winner and no point, and they have no scars or wounds, and like they just leave after like she's broken like 6 bottles over his head, and then they're like in the street the next scene. Like, I know when you're picking a sex partner, you usually fight them first and break bottles over their heads, but when you're hiring someone, you have to fight them then.
It's not just that, it's just it constantly nullifies its scenes. Like that scene you're talking about, she's going to make a business proposition anyway, so there's no reason for her to draw a gun. And the movie does that over and over. It just has lines and scenes that nullify themselves.
It was just supposed to be foreplay, like, oh you. But he killed her dad, you find out. Spoiler alert. So then it matters. And then at the end she's saying something about how, oh, we're going to get back to that killing the dad thing. Or after the soccer game and a bunch of other stuff. Yeah. Like, we'll still have sex and go to the soccer games together, but one day we're going to have a conversation. That dance, she called it.
Well, I think part of that comes from the comic book source material. So here's it's clearly the A-Team and they were expendables. I mean, clearly those things were made into a comic book, and then this comic book gets made into a movie, which is kind of pointless because you could have instead just gone back to the movies that obviously inspired this
comic
book. So it just felt like it was strained through so many different media until there was nothing left. but just unimaginative writing, characters who just weren't established at all, just broad strokes. I mean, these are basically the video game characters in a party-based mercenaries game or something.
Well, the A-Team on TV, they actually had distinct personalities from each other. So this movie's less developed than the A-Team TV series. Berg.
I guess so. Yeah, I guess so. But I don't know what the comic is like, but I could sort of imagine it's...
I don't either. That didn't mean that I knew it, but it made me not want to read the comic.
Yeah.
While I was Kick-Ass, I was kind of curious about the comic after we saw it.
Well, so what?
I don't see how there's anything here that would be interesting in a comic whatsoever.
Right.
I mean, I just sat there afterward going, there's just nothing, there's no twist, there's nothing interesting, there's no take here that makes me think, well, gee, the graphic novel or comic or whatever it's supposed to be would have something for me to sink my teeth into. It's just sort of bleh. I mean, besides from one moment where I wanted to tell the movie to fuck off, there's really nothing here.
Which moment was that?
This is my standard, and I realize I'm sort of becoming like, I'm Mr. Dad, what happens to kids in movies guy, but killing a chopper full of kids, any time that sort of.
But you don't see their bodies. You just see the bear.
I don't care. That's sort of using children as fodder to motivate people, as if you couldn't think of anything else to do. Well, let's just kill a chopper for
And they avenge the kids by going to the cockfights. That's their first act. Like,
so, Dingus,
right.
I don't
back someday.
Dingus, I don't know if you know this. There were actually no kids in the chopper when it blew up. Just to set your mind at ease.
There were CG kids.
There were actually kids, but afterward they said that it didn't change their behavior any. And they said if they ever got in a chopper, they'd be grounded for a week. So I was fine with them all being killed in that chopper.
Wait, who said that?
No.
The actor?
So that's Dingus. That's his MO, is to make an inside joke that nobody is ever going to get. So we'll just leave that there.
Oh, he's doing Chloe Moretz.
Right. So Dingus, what offended me about let's kill a chopper full of children to motivate our characters is how completely over the top and easy that is. I mean, that right there, classic, okay, this is some doofus writing a comic book. How can I make these guys good guys, give them a cause, also make them look particularly evil in terms of what they're being framed for having done? I mean, it was just such shorthand treatment of the stakes that are raised when a kid is involved. It was a footnote and a stupid footnote, and it was ineffectual, and I could see it coming a mile away. I was like, oh, please don't. You know what? That little prologue was basically beyond Thunderdome, you know, the third Mad Max movie that gets silly and it's about rescuing kids. It was such a stupid opening, I thought.
And it was doubly lazy because you could just see a note coming back saying, you know, don't just kill a kid, and then the writer going, okay, 25 kids. And then the studio going, okay, 25 works. That's good. That's stay.
I thought it was 43. They had 43 kids on there.
It's 25. It was a nice round number, I seem to recall. It was a quarter. You know, a quarter of kids.
Quarter hundred.
It's used so lamely later on.
Yeah.
It's just, well, we got to take revenge. We're going to take revenge on this. And then at some point, the comedian says, you know, he killed all those kids. And they all go, yeah, that's true. He did. Like, well, right. Well, they're going
to
do this.
The funny thing is, Dingus, they don't just say those kids. It's at a few points, they have to point out that they were, and I love when folks do this, they have to point out that they were innocent children.
Yeah.
Because killing guilty children, that's one level of crime. But when you kill innocent children.
Well, the uninnocent kid was the one having sex with their dad's murderer to,
They didn't even have the balls when the little girl says, my brother's upstairs, to make that an interesting moment. I mean, it would have been cool if you go upstairs and the brother's like this big dude or something. Instead, it's just a little kid with his knife to his throat. And again,
my brother's upstairs.
Another nullified scene where the guy puts down his knife and tries to talk some sense into the comedian. And then
gets shot anyway.
Gets shot. We don't even get to see it. It's just.
Well, it's the reveal. It's the character reveal where he confesses to her that, I killed your dad.
But you don't get to see him do it.
There's never any doubt about it.
They should have put a flashback in at that point for the people in the audience who weren't quite up to speed with what was going on.
So I didn't understand that. They get framed for that, but then they fake their own deaths and they make the frame work. Like, why didn't they go on the news and go, oh, yeah, we didn't do it. Look, see, we're alive, and it was our boss. It's all his fault.
Because it would have been a shorter movie?
Oh. And didn't the guy, helicopter pilot, go, oh, they're not on board, it's a bunch of kids, to the Jason Patrick character? Like, why would they want kids dead? Never mind. I didn't
Jason Patrick, Max was going to kill them regardless.
He was?
Yeah, that's what that was all
why?
About. Oh.
So he could frame them.
Right.
But why did they let him do it? And why didn't he kill them right afterwards and nuke that whole area with the Genesis device?
Because he thought, he didn't realize they had been successful in saving the kids and getting them on the chopper. His assumption is that they're
so
just
she counted
being
the teeth. He didn't have the teeth counted, so she's smarter than he is. The woman, Zoe Saldana character, smarter than Jason Patrick.
Also a better actor in this movie.
No, the scene where he shot a woman in the head was good.
I was so thrilled when the reveal was, because I didn't know he was in it, when the reveal was that our villain for today was going to be Jason Patrick.
And he had a flag lapel.
But that's with each successive scene, I became more and more despondent that our villain was Jason Patrick.
And he's wearing a Thomas Wolfe suit. That's kind of good.
Our villain for today. That's awesome. He was horrible.
God, no kidding.
He looks old, too. I felt bad.
Wanting to stand up and say, can we swap out Gary Oldman? Let's quick run over to the Book of Eli Theater, get Gary Oldman in here, because at least I believe that he's saying these words.
He was in Speed 2, so you said he was never in a bad movie. So he opened with Speed 2 and Lost Boys.
Well, Jason Patrick can be phenomenal. I mean, the guy's really a fantastic actor. Like, in Your Friends and Neighbors, which he produced. Yeah, I mean, that's just the work of a fantastic actor. That's just some great stuff in there. So I just hate to see him squandering.
Did his character fight at all? I mean, he didn't beat up the guys who took his watch, so I assume not. But
No, he just runs away. But he's just horrible. He's saying these lines in that on the set of The Arrival, in the Puerto Rico scene with Mr. What's his name?
Wade.
Mr. Wade, thank you. That scene is so horrid where he's doing the whole get 18 guys in a fire squad. Did you get it? Did you get it?
Oh, Dingus, I just thought of something, Dingus. In case I didn't mention it before, get 18 guys in a fire squad.
In 12 hours.
No, right. I knew there was a 12 in there, right?
Like, yeah.
You're going to have to do that joke 3 more times.
Right. So another joke is
clear? New plan?
Another joke that came in, I counted this one 4 times, is, hey, this is wacky. They're in a beat-up car.
But then they get a yellow Hummer at the end, so they're not losers.
Whoa.
It's all that oil. Thanks, James Cameron. So I saw that.
Racist.
They also, the guy whose legs got shot, they did like 3 jokes about that, too. And by the way, in the trailer, they gave away the Chris Evans telekinesis scene. Like, they did the whole scene in the trailer.
So you were going to tell us, Kelly Wand, the trailer, because Dingus and I didn't see trailer, so the trailer for The Losers gives away
everything. Right. Entire scenes. And just but it's like a crazy quote of one-liners. And then when you see them in the movie, there's like no context. It's like the exact same one-liners, like, spread over 90 minutes. Like, there's no setups. Like, oh, we're sitting in a yellow car.
Right. My theory is that when you end up making a movie like this, you know what? They're just like, put everything in the trailer. Our objective is to get people out here opening weekend, as many as we can, whatever it takes. And that's one of the cool things, by the way. That's one of the cool things about the trailer for we've talked a little bit about How to Train Your Dragon. Is I think the trailer for How to Train Your Dragon, which I watched and then saw the movie. And after seeing the trailer, I was like, oh, well, they just gave away the whole movie. But then I go and see the movie, and I realize, they very cleverly kept some cards to their chest. And I think that's a sign of confidence in a movie. Whereas something like this, where they just dump the whole movie into the trailer, I can't help but think that that's a sign of them thinking, well, we've got to blow our wad as quickly as we can, get people in here. So that's my theory there.
Well, the title gives away that the dragon gets trained.
It does, yes. The trailer gives away even more, but there's still some nice stuff waiting, if you see. So the trailer gives away all the one-liners. Does it give away, like, the whole – it's got to give away the whole setup, I presume. Does it give away the twist that the joke – or the comedian did not kill – or did kill the drug lord?
I don't think so.
Okay. So that's something that was waiting for us.
The comedian.
That's not a twist, though.
Well, it's the only thing that they really – it's the only thing that I did not know was going to – everything in that movie – you know, okay, so they've got to do different heists that mean a different gunfight to get a different object. You know, there were three of these, right? Everything I knew, I could tell everything that was going to happen. I guess maybe Idris Elba's betrayal, I couldn't tell. But so the only two...
For the Losers, that is a twist. By the standards of that movie, it's definitely a twist.
Right, and not just for the Losers. When I saw the movie, someone behind me, like... four seats down, when Idris Elba, you know, pulls the gun and announces what he's done and he whacks the comedian on the forehead, a guy behind me in four seats down went quite loudly in the theater, went, "What?"
See? Target audience.
He was thrown for a loop.
Right.
There was somebody who, in one of my audience, it might have been Repo Man, where the guy said, "Holy shit," with that sort of...
When in Repo. At the end when it's...
Hey, come on. Let's not spoil other movies. I mean...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Let's not spoil Repo, man.
But I love those little audience moments. There was only, like, two people in my audience. So
did you guys go together? Yeah.
Yeah, I was the guy behind Tom.
Right. All right, let's talk a bit about the action sequences. How did you guys feel about the action sequences? There were a bunch of them. This is very much an action movie.
I liked one of them. I liked the last one. A little bit. It showed me something I hadn't seen before, which was a motorcycle, like a sniper shooting a motorcycle to deliberately blow it up into a plane cockpit that blows up the plane too. Like, that was the plan. Just make sure you hit the gas tank so it goes right at that angle into Idris Elba's last eye.
Well, okay. The dude flew into the engine first, so.
Right, that was also part of the plan.
Yeah.
He had to do it just – he had to hold his breath. Okay, easy does. He can make the shot. Okay,
How the hell did Cougar get up there, by the way? Or Cougar, Coyote. What's his
name? Yeah, he got up there. It's like Cougar, yeah.
I think it was Ocelot. Wasn't that Ocelot?
Nobody touches the hat.
Bobcat. How did he get up there? When did that happen?
That's his superpower. He's always up in the right where he needs to be. He knows that Chris Evans is going to run and miss the elevator, so he's, like, exactly where he needs to be for the telekinesis humor. He's awesome.
Well, they did tell him where his out was. That was the, you know, Chris asks for...
He's the only competent member of the team, actually. He's the only one who actually does, who gets shit done. And, like, except for the girl, I guess. Okay, what?
So what, tell me real quick, those bombs were called, like, Snookums? What the hell were the name of those?
Snooks,
right.
Stupid nukes.
Right. So if we were to look at the logic of this movie, we were to discuss, like, who did what to whom and how did it all turn out, am I not mistaken that there are three of these Snookums still floating around?
Yeah.
And a Ducati. Oh, no, the Ducati's minting here. Four Snooks and a Ducati. That's what this film should have been called.
So Jason Patrick can keep his job, even though he just tried to steal $1 billion and tried to blow up L.A. Port. Like, he still works for the government? Like, he never gets in trouble?
We don't know. We'll find that out in the sequel. But that is part of what the movie was doing, is that there are three of these bomb things on the loose. Did I read that correctly?
There was one to test, four to use. But we only saw the test and one use.
Right, so three get delivered to the L.A. port, one of which gets armed, and I presume disarmed and recovered. Where are the other ones?
The duct tape.
The other ones have been removed to somewhere. We don't know where. Why they delivered them a Ducati other than for the scene is not clear. But you're right, Tom. There's three snooks left somewhere.
We're only a quarter of the way into the story. There's three.
And they clearly are planning for sequels. And they left the bad guy alive. They think they're going to get sequels.
From what I understand, I think this is based on the first two of a series of comics. Like, this is based on the first two issues in a series of comics. So I think that's the source material. So, yeah, I think they are counting on at least the way the movie was shot, it's definitely open-ended. So, yeah.
There's 32 issues, so we're 1/16th into the Losers movies.
Based on its opening weekend performance, I don't think there's any danger of that, by the way.
Remember when McGee said before Terminator Salvation came out, like, the fans will decide if they want more of these, and then it, like, didn't do that good.
Yeah, well, the fans decided.
You, like, taunted them.
I think they could probably make some crappy knockoff foreign market films, you know, straight to DVD things, and make some money off of them. They're not going to get these actors to do those things, but I don't think they really care. They've got their three. What was Snoop? It was like Sonic Dematerializer or something.
Yeah. I would have liked to have seen more of those in action. I mean, I always that's one of those things where by the end of the movie, I'm just so not into it that I am rooting for some cool special effect where Los Angeles, the harbor there, gets sonically denuclearized or whatever. I was really hoping that thing would get set off.
No pollution. Green terrorism.
I was really hoping that final showdown would be on that cool Puerto Rican set of The Arrival / Contact. Because that seemed like you know, all those gangplanks and whatever weird stuff is going on there. But instead, they just went to L.A.
There was they shot on that thing and did nothing with it. It's just like walking on it down a gangplank.
Yeah, they might as well have just been on a ladder or a scaffolding, like outside of a building washing windows.
It was just, yeah, we got this awesome set and let's use it for some exposition. What do you say, folks? Yeah, okay.
And Deus Ex Machinas, including two of people on great heights that weren't there before. Just suddenly, like the girl was firing from a height, like she's suddenly there. And
well, Kelly Wan, to be fair, Chris Evans had some kind of, like he could like use some winch kind of thing that pulled himself up a rope. I'm sure they all were equipped with whatever those, you know, batarang belt things were. You didn't see when they're using them, but that's how they scaled to those great heights.
It wasn't Chris Evans, it was Cougar Alvarez.
I'm thinking of where Chris Evans drops down into the warehouse.
Oh, right.
And then later, like, shoots back up. So they all have them.
Right, and he's got this great series of one-liners. He just pops down and says disco, and then go petunias, and the crowd goes wild. And he just pops up and down like a, I don't know, Pop-Tart or something.
This is late in the movie, but I had known beforehand that the movie was poorly written. But what sealed the deal is when one of the punchlines to an exchange between some of the characters is, "Your mama's a pirate." At that point, I was like, "Yeah, I don't think this is very well written."
Tom, you didn't grow up on the streets. Trust me, you hear that a lot if you're white.
I must also give them kudos for getting far more mileage than I ever would have expected out of a single Journey song.
One
Journey song. They used that. They paid for their rights, and damn it, they were going to use that at every opportunity.
Take that, Sopranos.
They clearly play Rock Band, and they're like, hey, let's have Chris Evans sing this song.
And then let's play it during the chase scene, and then let's do a callback to it during the soccer game at the end. Yeah.
Oh, because it's his character. That song is...
It's like his leitmotif, right?
And Pooch's character is that he's married. That's his character.
Right.
Okay.
You know, Jensen's other leitmotif was his T-shirt thing. What was it with the T-shirt fetish?
Am I the only one here noticing that T-shirt?
it was for the soccer team, so they knew he wasn't dead, so they're not fake their deaths. Okay.
But he
how can they be seen at a
goofy
soccer game if they're still fugitives? Aren't they still fugitives? Jason Patrick's still in charge at the end?
Could be. Don't know.
Doesn't matter, does it? It's just like that Hulk movie where at the end he turns into the Hulk and you don't even know where he is or what. Whether he and Liv Tyler are together, and I don't remember.
That's comic book rules. You don't need to explain all that stuff, Kelly Wand. It's just as long as you can draw a panel and put some dialogue in it, that's all you need.
But in The Dark Knight, at the end...
That's not a comic book movie, Kelly Wand.
Yeah, that's what makes it good, I guess.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, Dingus, I cut you off. What were you going to say?
No, I was just going to talk about the T-shirts, which is just so pathetic. But he was just constantly switching into new clever T-shirts, like I Gun Zombies and
I didn't see that one.
girl eating a hot dog. He just, every scene, he had a new clever T-shirt that the director clearly liked or that the costume designer had just gotten from Snorg Tees or whatever internet T-shirt thing. And it was just another sort of, we have nothing clever to say, so let's put a funny T-shirt on this guy kind of thing about this movie.
You know what, Dingus, what that makes me think of is, so Peter Berg wrote this script. Peter Berg is the director of the Runabout, the Roundabout.
I can't wait to see his take on Dune.
Wait, what is the movie with The Rock and William Sean Scott Penn? It's the Runaround.
Whatchamacallit.
It's the Roundabout. It's about driving around New England.
No, yeah. Shut up. Don't make me Google this because it'll cut off.
It's the Runaround. You're right.
The Runaround. No, it's not.
The Gobbledygook.
Rundown,
because, oh, right, like the Bulls do with that, right. So he directed The Rundown, he directed Very Bad Things, he directed Hancock. But I think the best indication that Peter Berg is really a funny guy and should be able to make a consistently funny movie is his commentary track on PU-239.
Yeah, yeah.
Which he produced. Another guy directed it, a guy who's kind of a friend of his. And the commentary track on PU-239, Peter Berg is amazing, because what happens is he shows up to do the commentary track with this guy, and he proceeds to grief the guy throughout his commentary track. He will say things like, "Where'd you get the wallpaper in that scene? That's really interesting. What kind of tree is that?
What kind of tree is that?
Did you hire those strippers? That's kind of obscene what she's doing. Did you tell her to do that?"
Wait, who's he talking to?
He's talking to the director. He and the director are doing the commentary track on PU-239, which, by the way, is an excellent movie and not a comedy.
But it's not a great movie, right?
No. PU-239 is Patty Considine as a scientist in Russia who tries to smuggle out some nuclear material, who actually does smuggle out nuclear material.
It's not that John Bon Jovi movie.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought it was the McConaughey sub-movie.
No, PU-239 is, I guess, the symbol for plutonium? I don't know. It's
the
chemical
compound.
But anyway, so the director has Peter Berg doing the commentary track with him because Peter Berg was instrumental in producing it. And Peter Berg is just hilarious. I just loved that guy in that commentary track.
He's completely endearing because he does that. He pretends he's an idiot.
Yeah.
He pretends he's a stupid Hollywood producer. And he's not just saying, you know, did you hire those strippers to make fun of the guy? He's acting like he's too stupid to know what to do in a commentary track. That thing of what Tom said about what kind of tree is that, he's totally – and he just gets lost. He starts eating, I think, in the middle of it. It's completely charming.
Man, now I feel bad for hating the writing and the losers.
He's good in that John Dahl movie with Linda Fiorentino.
No, Peter Berg's also a good actor, and he's great in Midnight Clear as the reluctant officer, the guy posing as the officer. I like Peter Berg.
Maybe he was just being true to the material. Maybe he's awesome, and he's just, oh, I got to do the losers.
Could be.
What are you going to do?
Well, Akiva Goldsman was involved, so.
Oh, my God. Good point, Dingus. When at the end, when the credits flashed up, and I was like, Joel Silver, Akiva Goldsman, right, I see what happened here. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. If you'd seen that at the beginning, you would have known the next 90 minutes.
I think I would have been a little bit more prepared for what I was in for, yeah. Now, you guys, come on. You guys defend the movie some. I thought I was the one being all down on it. Defend it some. Tell me about where I'm wrong, what I missed that didn't make it a completely wasted 90 minutes.
I got claws out another guy's eye, which I liked. And Jason Patrick shot a chick in the head for screwing up his umbrella for a second. I like that.
But Kelly Wan, you liked a few of the basically sight gags or sort of some of the setups and a couple of the sight gags. Okay, fair enough. Dingus, your turn. What do you have to say to defend this movie?
There was a moment where the music reminded me of Nolf. That's that moment. there was a moment where I was tempted to like the fight scene between Aisha and the comedian.
Clay?
Where it just became overtly and clumsily sexual, where he like slams her against the wall and, oh, look, they're pounding each other. Oh, it's a fight
scene. Get it?
They're having sex and fighting.
Yeah, that's good. You're right.
But sadly for me, it felt like, you know, and I'm really glad that we're doing the 3x3 we're doing, because that fight scene is just such an – it's like an awkward musical number in a bad musical. And it made me think about how much a good fight scene needs to be integrated the way a good musical number needs to be integrated in a musical. And, you know, when they're beating the hell out of each other, and it starts with him just, you know, him saying, you're not going to hurt me, and then just punching her, and ha-ha, man punches a woman. And but like so many other scenes in this, it's just nullified by the fact that it's an unnecessary scene. Like that, like later.
Yeah. Well, there's no impact from it. Like, afterwards, they're not even, like, limping or, I don't know.
Well, that's true. That's true. It's like when Jensen gets shot in the arm, and then they sew him up, and he just uses his arms as normal later.
Right.
It's just that TV use of gun violence or a gun injury that it's just, you shoot him in the leg and he'll be fine kind of a thing. There's no femoral arteries. There's no problem. Shoot him in the arm, and he'll be able to use his arm in 5 minutes.
No, you're not complaining about that, are you?
No, I love it. Sorry, I'm supposed to say.
Well, you're being, I mean, seriously, those are if a movie sets those rules out. I mean, to this movie's credit, it was pretty consistent about that. It's not like
injury's not mattering.
Right, it's not like Kick-Ass where there are a few convenient moments where an injury does matter. In this movie, there was never any danger that any gunshot was going to kill anyone, and I mean, I don't mind that kind of Hollywood rules if they're applied consistently and they're not used to narratively jerk us around.
I hate gun battles without blood, except in James Bond.
Oh, wait, hold on. But so Dingus, is that like, did you really have a problem with that in a movie like this?
I find it annoying. If he's going to get shot in the arm, then, you know, have some effect of it later on.
Right.
Why not? I mean, they screwed around with it with Pooch's legs, and they made a whole gag about it for a scene and a half. Can you walk in those legs? What, is this stupid question day? Nobody told me this was stupid question day.
But see, I think just if you look at, like, the internal consistency of it, like the internal fiction that a movie or a book or a comic book or whatever creates, if you're going to use that for a joke that, you know, he gets shot in the legs, he can't walk, that's fine, but gunshots aren't really a big deal. There it's just used for a stupid joke. It's not used to, like, manipulate the audience into, like, oh, is he going to be okay? Or, oh, now it's serious kind of thing.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, I just got to say, I never mind when movies, if a movie wants to downplay and soft pedal the impact of a gunshot, I'm usually okay with that as long as I'm not going to be jerked around for accepting those rules. And I didn't feel that way in this movie. I mean, you're right. It's definitely like, you know, people get punched in the face and they don't bleed and they're fine and they get shot in the arm and they're okay. But I tend to give a movie the benefit of the doubt if it's going to set those rules early on and stick to them. I don't know.
No, it certainly doesn't bother me as much as the way the film constantly nullifies its own scene.
Right, yes.
I mean, within a scene, like, for instance, the scene where Jensen gets his arm sewed up in the drugstore that they break into.
Mm-hmm.
All the guys are standing around, and I keep calling him the comedian. What's his actual character?
Clay and Henry Dean Morgan? I think Harry Dean Stanton.
Harry Dean Stanton, yeah.
Henry Dean Morgan, I believe, is the actor's name.
Jeffrey Dean Morgan.
Jeffrey Dean Morgan, good Lord. Thank you, Kelly Wand. So go ahead.
Within that scene, they all ask him, does she know about her families because she's betrayed them? And he finally admits it after 10 minutes of looking at them with puppy dog eyes. Yes. She knows about your families. So he tells them, go home to your families. And he's the colonel leader saying, go home to your families. And me and Roke, why are you trying to name Roke, are going to do it our own. You go home to your families. And then one by one, the dominoes fall. Oh, there's three idiots going to go. No, there's four idiots going to go. And everybody's looking expectantly at Pooch. Okay, five idiots are going to go. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the scene, Clay is like, yeah, we're all going to go. But you just told them to go home, fucker. And you don't even have to be convinced not to do the right thing. Within the same scene, he's gone from everybody go home to, yeah, we're all idiots.
Yep.
Going together. It just, none of the scenes have any sort of internal consistency.
Well, it's like when they find out she's hit the guy's daughter, but then she reveals it. In the same scene, like, you gave up your cover in that scene. Like, why? Phooey.
The fact that he gets shot in the arm or she gets shot, and you never, it doesn't really matter that she gets shot as well, doesn't bother me as much as the fact that the scenes were constantly being nullified.
Mm-hmm.
When did she get shot? In the bathroom?
Yeah. You see the bullet go through.
God, it's such a polite shot too. It's a very polite gun wound.
Well, because he loves her, so he's only shooting. He knows where she is. You know, Cougar's there. He knows where to shoot.
I want to go back. To,
it made me laugh, so I liked it more than you guys.
I want to go back real quick to the fight scene between Henry Dean Morgan and Zoe Saldana Navi. So there have been other instances of fighting as foreplay. Can you guys think of another scene that does that and that does it better?
Crash, the Cronenberg one.
Oh, is there? I don't remember the Cronenberg Crash very well. Is there that kind of thing where a dude and a chick are fighting and it's very clearly supposed to be sexual?
Well, they're getting into car accidents. That's like a fight. Let me start all over. Wolverine and Phoenix in X-Men 3.
Ah, okay.
She was like it. Yeah.
Good. Dingus, you got anything?
No, I'm reluctant to say anything because of where we're going.
No, give away the 3x3.
No, but I can't. I don't know where you're going, but Tom, go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm just, I mean, I'm sure there, I can't necessarily think of any. I mean, let me see. Isn't there... I'm sure at least one of the fights in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was. Well, you know what? Doesn't she fight the Mongol Desert Warrior dude? I don't know their names in Crouching Tiger.
Mongol Desert Warrior dude.
But there's that Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon during the long flashback. I think has one of those fight as foreplay kind of scenes.
Pierce Brosnan, Famke Janssen, and Goldeneye, kind of like.
Oh, you know what? That seems like a very James Bondy thing. As a matter of fact, what James Bond movie doesn't have a foreplay?
Right. And she always got horny when she killed people, so that was her character. So it was like, and he's like, "Ah, oh, you're taking this too far. You bit my lip, dude. Cut time out. We need a TO."
And I think there's something in Mr. and Mrs. Smith that has that feeling.
Ah, very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tom, what's your safe word? JK.
Okay, so we had the sex scene
and a payback too. There's a lot with Lucy Liu.
Oh, very good.
Ooh,
very good.
Yeah,
great one with Lucy Liu. Yeah,
damn,
she's good at that stuff. She always looks like she's having sex and fighting.
Tom's gonna need to take a break for a minute.
I'll be right back. Hold on.
Yeah, that's the only one that did it for me. Lucy Liu.
Would this movie have been helped? And I'm going to say yes before I even ask the question. If it hadn't been PG-13, would an R movie have redeemed it? I think with a little bit more...
Fuck yeah.
Yeah, I think it might have helped it.
Because, PG... Okay, the Omega Man was PG back in the day, the Charlton Heston movie, and it had boobs. I mean, nasty ones, but they were in it, and there's, like, tons of blood. I don't know. I yearn for those days. The nasty blood days.
Well, you're right. It certainly is hurt by the fact that we saw Kick-Ass last week. And Kick-Ass is a hard R. And that helped that movie, and it certainly would have helped this movie, especially seeing it back-to-back.
And I wonder, too, if in the source material, in this movie they are so careful to always use tranquilizer darts, you know, when they're shooting security guards and
not
stuff.
Not at the end, though. At the end, don't they only have the lethal guns, and then they shoot a bunch of guards?
Yeah, I wondered about that. Yeah, I guess when they're going up against... private corporation.
Since there's no blood, you can't tell what they're shooting with. That's another crappy thing about PG-13
right,
movies.
Right. And they didn't... did they cuss a lot? I don't seem to recall.
No. They would have, though.
Yeah.
If it was good. But they would have cussed coolly, like Clint Eastwood in Heartbreak Ridge. They would have found, like... I don't know. I think it would have been better if Clay had been more wretched and, like, kind of an alcoholic.
Right, right.
I would have reimagined him as kind of, like... Tony Stark pre-redemption kind of guy.
He does have that Robert, poor Jeffrey Dean Morgan. I mean, he does have that Robert Downey Jr. look to him.
Yeah. And also, like, they go to a cockfight and only one of them's drinking. Never mind. You know,
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 1 8 8 3, when I'm caught in between, counting 1, 2, 3.
Three by three. Who's up for a good 3x3 this week?
I thought you and I were going to have a cockfight, Tom.
Kelly Wan, what do you think we should do for this week's 3x3?
Top 3 fights in movies. Although I could listen to this music in silence for a long time.
How would you listen to it if it were in silence?
Well, the same way those kids are innocent as opposed to Chloe Moretz. Just looks innocent.
All right, do you need to refine that or elaborate on it at all?
I am not going to elaborate on it, but I stuck to certain rules that you guys are not necessarily beholden to. Because I like loosey-goosey 3x3s.
Boy, you sure do. This is as loosey-goosey as it gets, Kelly Wan. But I just want to take the opportunity, and then I'll shut up, to be the jerk who says, this is a terrible 3x3.
Yeah, it might be. But let's see what happens.
I mean, are you going to do top three villains next? Can we do that?
Oh,
top
crap.
Three sex scenes with Zoe Saldana.
Jeez.
Which you don't see. Nipples.
You are so incredibly like creative and unhinged when you actually think.
You know what? I didn't have a good one. I had actually some better ones, but for some reason.
Or top three fight scenes. Jesus.
You know what? I like annoying you. And that's.
Well done. All right. But having said that, I did enjoy what I came up with, and I've got a twist as well. So, however, I go first. Do I go first?
These lists give us a chance to rip on each other as to how they approach. We've all approached lists like, oh, that's what you call a fight. Ugh.
Well, it also right.
Typical Tom chick.
So let's see. The order is, I think, Dingus, you're next week, right?
Right.
So
you're supposed to have something to do with the movie we saw, and we saw Kick-Ass and the Losers.
No, they aren't. We can't expect that. So let's see. So the order will be who goes first.
I have a good one in 3 weeks. So. Look forward to that.
Okay, wait, who goes first? I've totally lost track of how.
Whoever's turn it is to give the list topic. So I think it's you.
So it's Dingus.
No, it's Dingus. It's Dingus.
So it's Dingus, right. Then me, then you, Kelly Wand. Okay, so Dingus, what is your number three top fight scene in a movie? And by the way, real quick before you go, did you? What was your approach? Did you have a twist or anything?
Did you think this was a crappy topic, Dingus?
Well, no, it's just what frustrates me, and I didn't realize this until a couple of weeks ago, is that because you leave it so open, I have to include things that are obvious. This happened to me on the drug list. And, you know, the week before when Tom was very restrictive about something, I was a little annoyed, but then I realized it gave me the freedom to choose something odd. Whereas you don't have that problem. You can do like a double feature and choose whatever the hell, and everybody's like, oh, Kelly Wan is awesome. But if it's open like this, you're like, it could be an argument. It could be if you have an itch on your underarm, that can be a fight.
Well, I want to see your panel. Yeah.
So for me, I went ahead and just stuck with I veered away from arguments because I think that that could be a separate list. I think arguments and debates, while technically fights, would be an interesting 3x3 in their own right if you sort of tailored them. So I just went with actual fights, my actual three favorite physical fights in films. And my list turns out pretty pedestrian.
But okay, I only did arguments, so this will be interesting.
Fantastic. But I can't get away from the fact that I love these fights, and I love the way they play out for different reasons.
See, Tom, he likes it. You're the fool.
I love fights in films, and I specifically love fights that stay away from CG. Although, you know, using CG is interesting in certain ways in films now as they're getting better, it becomes more distracting to me. So I like actual stunts that are done. I like an actual physical feel to the fight and an actual skill that it seems the actors have had to learn when they're actually grappling with each other, as opposed to the idea of Yoda flying around, which you referenced last week when we were talking about Kick-Ass. Which doesn't feel as, and I hate to use the word, but I'm going to use it anyway, which doesn't feel as visceral, doesn't feel as physical to me. So I used things that felt physical to me and felt like the actors engaging each other.
Mm-hmm. Good. So what is your number three from the...
All right, my number three has become, as I think about it, my favorite schoolyard brawl. And...
He's going to skunk me right now.
No, I'm not going to skunk you since you only used...
No, that's a joke. You're going to skunk me. I smell a skunk.
No, I'm not going to.
Okay, only two of mine are from The Losers. Spoiler alert.
You know, I actually almost did use all three from one film in the Navy.
I almost did that as well. What would did your the initials of your one film, CTHD?
What?
I don't have an HD DVD player, so I couldn't.
Those aren't bytes, Tom. That's wires. Wire food.
All right. I'm sorry, Dingus. We're cutting you off, so go ahead. What's your number three? Schoolyard Brawl. And I love that Kelly reacted strongly and thinks he's about to be scooped.
He's going
to
scoop my number two. Damn it.
I'm not going to, because it doesn't actually take place in a schoolyard. It's
okay, is it Willie Ames and Scott Baio versus the bullies at Magic Mountain and Zapped?
No, it's actually Passion of the Christ, and I think of that as a snake.
He didn't go to school.
It's a schoolyard brawl because it has that feel for me, but it doesn't actually take place in a schoolyard. And it was actually referenced by Tom in another 3x3.
So it's
and it is the credit sequence, the opening credit sequence from the film Duplicity.
Beautiful.
And I wanted to see this sequence again so badly, and it is impossible for me to find the clip. So I'm going to have to rent the damn film, which I don't want to see again. But I love that opening scene. I sat there in the theater and my jaw dropped open, because it's two groups of people in front of their private jets and in front of their lackeys or their workers, and they're two middle-aged men, or older, actually, and it's a slow motion, just musical sequence of two men charging at each other, and it looks like they're going to rip the skin and hair off of each other's bodies. And it just sets up an incredible chemistry for a movie that just drops. And if the two romantic leads had had half the chemistry that the people in the fight had had, I mean, the fight is a sexy fight, even though it's two old dudes ripping each other's skin off, and it doesn't even last that long. It's just like Paul Giamatti being thrown to the ground by Tom Wilkinson. But it just looms large in my head as this great, promising moment at the beginning of a film that then didn't deliver. But I love this fight. And I think of it as a schoolyard brawl, because it just has that feel of two people who have no skill but are just right. going to just rip into each other.
Well, part of the beauty of it, I think, Ding, is part of what sells that is, first of all, that Tom Wilkinson and Paul Giamatti are tremendous actors, very expressive. But it is shot in super, super extreme slow motion. So everything they're doing in their faces and with their bodies reads like you can. It's so languid and leisurely, and you could just see their posture and the anger in their faces and the glint in their eyes. And it so lovingly captures these two actors just sort of smacking each other ungainly. Yeah,
it's like a dogfight, and it sets up their conflict between each other beautifully. It just – you understand why they're at each other's throats for the entire film, although they never really – they don't have any physical contact. Right. And this moment, whether it's real or not, it just has this just amazing power to it.
And then the rest of the movie happens.
Yeah, and then the rest of the movie happens.
This is a romantic comedy, right?
No, it was a sort of a thriller. That's how.
So it's the Julia Roberts Clive Owen movie that's not Closer. Right?
Closer.
I think someone said it was Closer.
Pretty sure it's Closer. But no. Yeah, right. It's that other one. Yeah. All right, good. So number three. All right. My number three is the fight between.
Are you going to give us your twist first, or are you going to?
Maybe not. You know what? Okay. I think anybody can come up with fight scenes between two people. My fight scenes are all between people and inanimate objects. So my number three is the fight between Tom Cruise's acting and the chair in Collateral. Because in Collateral, that's the Michael Mann movie where he wants to shoot Jamie Foxx. He's supposed to chase Jamie Foxx through an office building. And at one point, Jamie Foxx has like gone around on the other side of a glass wall. So Tom Cruise, you know, here's how I imagine the setup. Pretend I'm Michael Mann. I'm talking to Tom Cruise here. Here's how it goes. Okay, Tom, we want you to take this chair. You throw it through that glass, and then you just run through and you go after Jamie, and then I'll call cut. So that's probably the instructions that Tom Cruise was given. So they start shooting the scene. Tom Cruise picks up the chair. He throws it through the window. He goes through the window. But what the choreographer for that fight scene had not foreseen is that the chair is going to be sitting there where Tom Cruise is going to walk. So he totally busts his ass when he steps on the chair. It is amazing. And then he gets up and keeps going. So Tom Cruise's acting defeats the chair in Collateral, and that would be one of my three favorite fights between a person and an inanimate object. There you go.
That chair was so prepared for that scene, too.
Well, you're saying the chair's acting sucks, which I don't agree with.
It's not about the chair's acting. It's about its fighting prowess. It brought Tom Cruise down. It felled Tom Cruise. It did not, however, defeat Tom Cruise's performance. Tom Cruise did not go, oh, I fell, cut, do it again. He got up and he stayed in the scene. Tom Cruise's acting prevailed against the chair.
Mm. So all yours are from that movie?
Can I guess your other two now?
No, you can't.
Are they all Michael Mann?
So, all right, that's my number three. Kelly Wand, what is your number three top fighting scene?
My number three top fighting scene, mine are all 1v1s because I thought that's what a fight was. And I didn't do any Bruce Lee stuff or like kung fu things because you never really care who they're fighting.
Good point. Very good point.
I picked fights where you know both the contestants, you know something about them, so you're invested in it. Mm-hmm. My number three is Casey Samosko versus Buddy Ravel at the end of 3 o'clock High.
Schoolyard bully, very good.
I love that fight, and it ends with brass knuckles, which is like a plot point throughout the movie, and then they wind up becoming. All right, that's my number three. Okay, go.
Who directed 3 o'clock High? Do you know offhand?
No, I'll Google it.
That's a really good movie. I've forgotten about that.
That guy looks like you, so you should like that movie.
Who does?
You look like Casey Samosko.
Oh, by the way, I'm really impressed, Kelly, with the fluidity with which you can say his name.
Phil Schwanow directed it. The guy who made the...
Oh, yeah, yeah. And who did the movie with Gary Oldman about the Irish mob, Hell's Kitchen movie. I don't remember the name of that.
State of Grace.
State of Grace.
His Irish phase.
Wow, well, you know what? That makes sense, because 3 o'clock High is not just some throwaway teen comedy thing.
No, it's good. And I like movies where something about the way people move and their like the way they fight reveals something about their personalities. And the way those two characters fight at the end, I don't know, just says a lot about them.
Yep.
And I like fights where you go in and you're sure you're going to lose and you still fight. That always, like, stupid courage always moves me.
I think any good fight scene should be, and so far Dinks's and yours apply, any good fight scene should not just be a fight scene, it should be character development.
Right. Yeah. Totally.
Good.
Okay. Right.
Heaven's Prisoners, which was also a Phil Schwanow movie. Terry Hatcher was nude in it, so it was like, never mind.
He did that U2 film, too.
Yeah. I saw it at the theater, and I felt dumb. Rattling dumb.
Well, I love State of Grace.
Is that the Sean Penn, Ed Harris one?
That's Gary Oldman.
Yeah.
The one we already talked about. I just wanted to say I loved it.
All right. So, Dingus, over to you. What is your number two top fight scene between a person and an inanimate object?
Your furniture?
Maybe. Dingus, what is your number two?
Because a futon would be foot-based, like kickboxing. Sorry, Dingus.
All right. Mine is a man versus a Christmas tree pole.
Ugh.
I think I know what it is, but I don't want to... Oh, you're lying. You were lying. All right, go ahead.
You are lying. All right, here's a quote from it. You fellas want to do a quote?
Sure. I'm going to guess it, too. I'm going to know this one. Go.
All right, go ahead.
You got to say the quote first.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. What do you have?
It was go ahead.
What do you say, Jack? Would you like a shot at the title?
Midnight Crossing. Or Midnight Run.
Midnight Crossing.
What do you say, Jack? Would you like a shot at the title? It's either Midnight Run or Big Trouble in Little China, because the character's name in that is Jack. It's got to be Midnight Run, because isn't he Jack?
It's not anybody named Jack, actually.
Didn't you just say, what do you say, Jack? How would you like a shot at the title?
Yeah, but it's like, what are you doing, Jack? It's just sort of a Jack, you know, because he doesn't feel like calling him by his actual name.
So he calls him Jack, but even though that's not his name, that's absurd. Who would do
that? Hey, people call each other Jack.
Kelly Wan, do you know this movie? Because I don't think I've seen it.
Midnight Crossing?
No, the one from Dingus's line. Can you guess it?
What was the line? It seems like forever ago that we heard it.
Give me a different line. How about this? That's that same albino jackrabbit son of a bitch that took out Hunsaker.
Oh, that Burt Reynolds movie, Stick, because that had an albino in it. Oh, Foul Play, albino. Wait.
No. The character who's being called Jack says this line, "You may call me Mr. Joshua."
Oh, it's got to be a Quentin Tarantino movie.
Oh, you guys suck. All right, this is a movie from 1987, directed by Richard Donner, called Lethal Weapon.
Ah, albino. Gary Busey.
Mm. Yeah, very good.
He's the albino I always forget.
The albino I always forget. Mm. What do you get for the albino you always forget? There's this absurd fight scene at the end of that movie and it takes place on Danny Glover's lawn.
Yeah,
with about 5,000 cop cars all around. And I love how contrived this fight scene is. And I love how physical it is and how it uses some of these goofy ideas of water and darkness and light. And he does actually fight him with the pole of a Christmas tree decoration, which is, he just like seems to, he crashes into this weird Christmas tree pole and then ends up swinging. It looks like he's got a swing set that he's swinging at Mel Gibson. And I love the excuses they make for the contrivances in this scene, because at one point Mel Gibson almost gets drowned in this pond in his front yard because they've run over a fire hydrant, which is spraying into the yard. It's Los Angeles, so there's no reason for it to be raining. But they're making a nod to this, the fact that so many of these goofy scenes, even in Los Angeles, take place in the rain. And instead, they just have a fire hydrant spraying water on the lawn. And Mel Gibson almost gets drowned. And there's cops everywhere. And Danny Glover is just running around yelling, it's my responsibility. This guy killed a couple of cops. Let them fight. They're fighting, and Mr. Joshua doesn't care that there's 1,000 cops around. He just wants to fight. And it's very clear it's a title fight. At the end, he says, do you want to go for the title? And he says, yeah, don't mind if I do. And it's this very physical sort of getting punched in the ribs and kicked in the ribs. Mm. And it ends. And this is why I specifically chose it for this week, because Mel Gibson ends up in this leg hold with his legs wrapped around Gary Busey's neck. Like he could break his neck with his legs. And it's this weird, and he's thrusting in this weird sexual way that makes much more sense than the sexual fighting in The Losers. It's disturbing and slightly sexual, and then he just decides, it's not worth it. He lets him go. But I just love, I remember seeing it and just love the sort of like tearing into each other and physical nature of this fight.
Good.
He also almost strangles, he uses his feet on that guy who's electrocuting him right before that, doesn't he? Isn't that how he gets out of the electrocution?
On Endo. Endo. Yeah.
So he's like the male Famke Janssen.
I think that's how he bills himself.
But he's Australian, too.
All right, Lethal Weapon.
Australian for Famke. Tom's disgusted right now.
No, not at all. That's a good one, I guess. I don't know. I haven't seen Lethal Weapon probably since I was a kid.
Will is in 1987. So there you
Mel
go.
Versus the House in Lethal Weapon 2 is one of my runner-ups. Remember that?
You might be stealing Tom's.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Right. Furniture. Okay.
He kicks that house's ass, by the way. All right, my number two, though, actually. So now my number three was a bit facetious, but the next two are very serious in that I really do love these scenes. And I did love Tom Cruise busting his ass. That was great. But these next two are seriously, like, good scenes in great movies, I think, and it's a man and it gets an inanimate object. Number two is Adam Sandler versus the bathroom in Punch Drunk Love. It's a scene where... things are coming to a head. He's out on a date. He's under a lot of pressure. We've established the fact earlier in the movie that he can freak out. So he's out on a date, and he's really into this girl, and he gets some distressing news and things, and so he excuses himself. And he goes into the restroom of this little Italian restaurant somewhere in the valley and just freaks out and smashes the divider by the commode and pulls down the paper towel thing. And it's just like, I think it's just like one overhead shot. And Punch Drunk Love one of the amazing things about that movie is the sound. I think actually they did sound at Skywalker Ranch. Like it was an ILM sound design. And the sound during that scene distorts. It's very clearly part of the sound design, and it's such a reflection of his state of mind at that point. And I love that part of Punch Drunk Love, and so that's my number two is Adam Sandler versus the bathroom. And by the way, Adam Sandler wins the fight, but he gets busted for having messed up the bathroom and basically kicked out of the restaurant. So it then goes to, I guess, a tie.
He gets injured in the fight, though.
And he does. He does sustain an injury. That's right.
You should see the other guy.
That's not his only fight, though. So, but I don't want to ruin your next one. I thought this was where you were going. I thought you were going to do this for your number one.
No, my number one I love. My number one is one I don't think you guys know.
Wasn't that on your last list?
Adam Sandler versus the bathroom?
Yeah, this sounds really familiar.
No, I mentioned it as a possibility for another.
So it's your guys' Zapped. Punch Drunk Love. It's in every list somewhere. Someone.
Should be.
I haven't seen it. Because it was an Adam Sandler movie.
Well, he fights another piece of furniture in this movie.
Hmm. Tom's quiet.
He does? I'm trying to think what piece of furniture he fights. He didn't fight the piano. He doesn't fight the forklift. What are you talking about, Dingus?
In the scene with at the dinner party.
Where he smashes the patio window?
It's not the patio window. It's like this enormous piece of furniture that has a huge glass front to it that he breaks.
I'm pretty sure he smashes a patio window, doesn't he?
Right. Well, he's fighting. Whatever.
That's not, the patio window doesn't put up much resistance, though, unlike the bathroom in the top.
A window's not really furniture, though, is it?
I would disagree that it's a window. I think it's a part of a piece of a display case, and Tom is misremembering it.
A window has more definitions than MacGuffin.
And by the way, that scene, though, it's another great example of the sound design in Punch Drunk Love. It's a static shot of Adam Sandler next to whatever glass it is that he's going to break, and the sound of everybody talking and carrying on and the merrymaking. You know, he's very uncomfortable there. It builds, you know, the way he's hearing it. And it's there to represent the increasing pressure on him. So P.T. Anderson, with only Adam Sandler in the shot, creates this oppressive sense of just being overwhelmed by a crowded room and then having a freak out. I need to go back and watch that. If you guys will excuse me, I'll be back in about 90 minutes. All right, Kelly Wand, what is your number two favorite fight scene?
They Live, Roddy Piper versus Keith Good. David.
Okay, whatever. Let's move on. Dingus, what's your number one? I recalled hating that as a kid. I haven't seen the movie since then. But as a kid, I recall thinking, what are they doing? Why are they doing it? This is stupid. This is just in here so that this wrestler dude can be in a fight scene.
No, it's not. He's trying to make him wear glasses.
I know.
If he would put those glasses on, there wouldn't be a problem.
But he didn't break the glasses, which means he wanted to fight. So it's a sexual fighting, kind of like the comedian versus Idris Elba in Losers that Dingus was talking about.
I hated that. Okay.
What? You hated that fight scene? It didn't make you laugh?
You know, I think they...
You're a heart of stone, Tom Chick.
I do, yes. That is correct. I think a lot of my disappointment in They Live came from my love for Big Trouble in Little China. That was what I wanted from a John Carpenter movie back then, and that's not what They Live was at all. So
They Live sucks, but then there's that one good scene that tricks you into thinking that it's going to get good. But it's just the only
that fight scene, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's all one shot, too.
I would doubt that very seriously.
All right, well, it's like 40, but...
Maybe it is. I mean, if it is, then you know what? Hats off to... So that's Keith...
The thing you didn't like about it is what I liked about it. Like, just the fact that it was so gratuitous and dumb.
Right.
I don't know. That's endearing to me. That's what I wanted from a John Carpenter movie. He's giving you a sly wink, Tom.
I don't think there's anything sly about... I mean, a wrestler show-off. A wrestler.
But Keith David...
I'll give props to Keith David, learning rap.
It's his best fight scene ever.
Okay.
Just saying.
I'm sure that was
I think it's, what is the number one fight scene of all time?
Yeah, what is? All right.
Because this category is so wide open, I cannot not include this as my favorite fight scene ever.
I know what it's going to be.
I know what it's going to be.
Yes, I wouldn't mind you guys guessing. Go ahead.
It's going to be some Star Wars thing. It's going to be either Darth Maul or maybe the one in Return of the Jedi. One of those two.
Darth Maul or Return of the Jedi.
Yeah. Some Star Wars thing. You love those Star Wars deals.
I won't deny that I flirted with the Empire Strikes Back considering this.
Okay.
But the special effects kind of threw me. I didn't really want something with special.
Right. You did mention that. All right. Okay. I retract my guess then.
I thought it was too. Yeah. I thought I was going to say Empire. So I guess you fooled me.
All right. I'll give you fellas a quote. How about that?
I'm going to get this one. I'm going to get this one to make up for the last one.
I think you'll get it.
Okay.
You ready?
Yep.
Unless the enemy has studied his Agrippa, which I have.
Ah, yes, yes. Actually, this one was suggested to me by someone who, before I was going to take it, before I took my own particular angle, if I was just going to do straight-up boring old fight scenes, this one you can't really not consider.
Someone suggested this to you?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would have thought of it anyway, but someone sent me, when I told her we were doing this 3x3, she sent me a bunch of suggestions, one of which, by the way, I'm really bummed I didn't use, because when she told me about it, I remembered it, and I was like, oh, that's awesome. We'll talk about it during the runners-up. But no, this is a great one, Dingus. You cannot – I think any in-earnest scene about fights that takes into account that fights need to be character development, there needs to be good choreography, this one belongs there. So take it away. What makes this work, Dingus? Well, oh, and what is it?
Kelly clicked. So, Kelly, what do you got?
Kelly, do you really have to Google that? Did you Google Agrippa or what? How did you go about that?
I didn't find it, though.
Did you really not recognize the quote Kelly Wand?
I think I just got a virus, actually. Wait, what's the quote? I like it for the gripper. I didn't know with Nail and I. Wait, I didn't know I was a gripper. It's got to be sexy beast.
Give him a better quote, Dingus. So give him one of the money quotes.
Train spotting. Wait, what? Okay.
I don't know if you're not going to get that one, I don't know if you'll get any of them. Oh, okay. Here's the most obvious one. No, I don't want to give him an obvious quote.
Let's say the movie.
I'm pretty dumb. No. Give me one more chance. I'm really stupid, so that'll make it a fun game to listen to for people who already know it.
So actually, this will help, Dingus. I was at, where was I recently? Oh, yeah, so there's that dance thing, and there's a guy, no, where was it? Anyway, a guy had made a name tag, one of those, hello, my name is, name tags, and then it's a big blank thing down there, and he had written in there, Inigo Montoya, and you killed my father. Like, he wrote that in the little space, which was really good, and a great conversation starter, and it's like, oh, I wish I'd thought of that.
You were the dance thing?
Yes.
Was this your date?
Now, where did I see this? I forget who had this name tag on, but it was a great idea.
Tom's a good body popper.
Was it Charles's park party?
No, I don't remember where I saw it. But go ahead. So tell us what the movie. We still have not given away the movie. So nobody knows, Dinkus. So you have not been scooped yet.
All right. This is another 1987 movie. This one directed by Rob Reiner, called The Princess Bride. And this is easily my favorite fight in a film. And I watched a couple times. I went ahead and watched it today, and I just kept watching it over and over again. I can't leave it out. It's just the way the fight is set up, the character of the fight, which Tom just referenced, the choreography of it, the dialogue, the humor, the way the fight finishes. It's beautiful. It's perfect. It even makes fun of movie fights, and it has a little Gymkhana moment that's very funny to me, and it's very obvious, and they're not trying to get away with anything, but there's obvious skill here, and I've studied sword fighting to a certain extent. I'm no good at it, but I understand what actors have to do to learn to do it and learn to look proficient at it. And what's there's a cool factor that it starts awkwardly, and then they explain why it's awkward because they're fighting left-handed, and then it goes into much more skill, and then has a lovely ending about artistry, and then it leads off, and I sort of alluded to this earlier, it leads off into two other fights that I almost used for this whole category. They're very different. One's a battle of wits and one is just brawn. And this is skill.
Oh, yeah,
and,
right.
And it's really just lovely. The actors work together beautifully and the dialogue is fantastic. And I could watch this fight again and again. And I know it's more popular amongst people who understand sword fighting to pick something like Rob Roy as having the best sword fight of all time. But I am so in love with this sword fight in The Princess Bride. I think it's beautiful, and there's also sort of this love for the instruments they're using. There's a sense that the characters I'm not going to say fetishize in the way that the losers is gun porn, but in the way they love a well-made sword and they understand what that is and what that does for them. And they also understand what training does for them. And I love how these characters understand training and they use their training against each other. And this is a contest that they have honor and it just works beautifully in this film.
Kelly Wand, why did you go, when Dingus said Princess Bride, why did you go,
Isn't that a sword fight?
Yeah, yeah.
It's own list. That's all I'm saying.
Have you not seen Princess Bride? Like,
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But, I mean, Andre the Giant's the fighter, I thought.
Of course it's his own list, but you didn't say that!
I know.
You didn't narrow it down.
Well, I wanted to get rid of all the fight lists in one fell swoop, so we didn't have to do them anymore.
All right.
They are coming back.
I know. I basically screwed myself, because then I was like, oh, wait, can't do the sword fight.
Well, my number one is not a sword fight. You'll be glad to know, Kelly Wand. It involves no implements. It's strictly hand-to-hand combat, and it is between Max von Sydow and a birch tree in Virgin Spring. And no joke, that's how it unfolds. I think I've talked about it before on the podcast because I only saw Virgin Spring for the first time, it was the beginning of the year. So, you know, like 4 months ago, it was the first time I'd seen it. It's a fantastic movie. God, I loved that movie. And what happens is before Max von Sydow has to murder these guys to avenge his daughter, because the movie is set when it's set, you know, he's a very devout Christian. He has to do some ablutions. He has to sort of cleanse himself. And he needs birch branches to do it. So here's this bereaved guy whose daughter has been murdered, who is about to then commit murder himself, even though he's a devout Christian. He goes out onto this plain, and it's just a beautiful one shot. You know, it's one shot. The camera's far away. You see the one tree sticking up in the middle of a flat plain. Max von Sydow goes out to it, and he doesn't have anything to cut it down with, and I don't know if it's because he didn't want to bring anything or because he forgot, but he proceeds to wrestle this tree to the ground. it's just such a great sequence, and it's such a part of the movie. It's almost this, you know, the Christian man taming the pagan symbol in a way. And he literally, you know, it's Max von Sydow fighting a birch tree. Now, it's not a big old thick tree. You know, obviously Max von Sydow is going to win. But, you know, Ingmar Bergman knew enough that this would be a visually striking thing to just set up the camera and tell Max von Sydow, you know what, go out there and bring that tree down. And it's phenomenal. So I love that movie, and that would be my number one fight scene of a man against an inanimate object.
You can't pick movies we haven't seen or heard of by Swedish people.
Now you guys haven't seen Virgin Spring, am I correct?
No, but you mentioned it when you saw the remake, and I think there was a thread that had a title about fighting a tree, and I thought you were just joking, but the way you speak about it now makes me really want to see this movie.
Yeah, no, there was. I think I did post about it on the forum, but I'm not joking. It is quite literally a fight scene between Max von Sydow and a tree, and it's not at all ridiculous. It's a very important poignant part of the movie. And it's not a spoiler or anything, but, you know, actually the whole plot line of the movie isn't really a spoiler. It's one of those amazing movies that even if you know exactly what's going to happen, as I did in terms of the sequence of events, it still just has a lot of power in that movie.
So it's a real birch tree, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know what? I'm assuming it's a birch. I don't really know my trees. It's a thin white tree, and he has to strip the branches off that he's going to use. He doesn't really flagellate himself, but he uses them in some ritual bath thing. So he brings the tree down, and he strips the branches off.
Well, birch is what they use for the flagellation, so, right?
Couldn't tell you for sure.
But Swedes, birches don't grow. They're not native to Sweden.
They were back in 14...
That's true.
All right, so Kelly Wand, you have not seen Virgin Spring, huh?
No.
Okay. That's okay.
I've seen a couple of Bergmans. I saw Persona and I saw Seventh Seal. I didn't think no one said to see Virgin Spring when I was in film school, so I thought it couldn't be that good.
What the heck kind of film school doesn't tell you to see Virgin Spring? Weird.
It was a dumb film school.
All right, so... Kelly Wand, what is the number one fight scene of all time for you?
I'd have to go with Jason Voorhees versus the telekinetic in Friday the 13th, 7 New Blood. Just kidding. I thought about it, but I forget how it ended. I almost went with Any Which Way You Can, because I remember thinking that was a good fight scene.
Is that the Monkey Clint Eastwood movie?
Yeah, he fights a dude with a broken arm.
I thought that was Any Which Way But Loose.
No, that's the first one. He loses that one.
There are multiple Clint Eastwood and a monkey movies?
Yeah, there was Biggest Hits till Gran Torino was his biggest hit ever, which tells you a lot about the American public and Clint Eastwood, doesn't it? More than any Dirty Harry movie, Gran Torino.
No, come on.
I read it on the internet, so it's true.
It's only because it was in 3D.
So you didn't go with that. What did you go with, Kelly Wong?
I went with, I would do a quote, but it's all in Chinese. Stephen Chow at the end of God of Cookery. He makes sorrowful rice. It's like a cook war against this other guy named Tong. It's like a cook fight. And his other dish gets blown up with a bomb, so he makes this rice dish with pork, even though he doesn't have any time left.
Why does he fight Tong? What are they fighting about? I don't understand.
Can't remember.
What makes this the best fight scene of all time?
It's just they fight with food, so it's sensual.
Okay. So it's like Big Night.
Yeah, it's like Night and Day, that Tom Cruise movie. It's Killers, Catherine Heigl.
All right, so Stephen Chow versus Tong in God of Cookery.
That's my number one best fight scene in a movie.
I will have to see that then, if if it's that good.
Oh, you didn't see that? Huh. Virgin Spring. Interesting.
All right, good. So there we go. Those nine movies with fighting that everyone should see. Doesn't get any better than those. Let's talk about a little bit about what we ruled out. So the Rob Roy fight scene, I have to agree with, because I love how that fight scene is incredibly plausible, how Tim Roth is obviously more skilled than Liam Neeson's character, and how something about Liam Neeson's character, mainly his perseverance and how he's a bigger, tougher guy, ends up being what wins him the fight. And he doesn't win the fight because he's the good guy, which is normally the case. So Rob Roy is just an amazing fight scene, and it's a great cap to the movie as well. The way it's positioned in the movie, the way it's set up. For me, any good... I used to think this about car chase scenes. My idea about a car chase scene is that it needed three things. It needed character. You had to care about the characters. It needed context. You had to know why it mattered if this car caught this other car. And it needed choreography. The cars had to do cool stuff. But I actually think that applies to all action scenes and certainly fight scenes. So as far as those criteria in that fight scene at the end of Rob Roy, I think that's a fantastic fight scene.
Yeah.
Okay, that's my number one. but he uses his size. That's a good example of what, where it's like, the way you fight is governed by how you're, like Yoda
Oh, good Lord.
But it's also for one of the things I love about it is that it's clear, and I really love the way these actors have learned this skill. I love that, and they're proficient at it, and it, to the point where you don't really notice the fact that it's actors learning a skill. It's that these characters are fighting.
And that's, yeah, like the Matrix kind of spoiled that. Like you can't have stuntmen anymore. Like I just remember how awesome that was seeing Keanu Reeves and Larry Fishburne in The Matrix doing all those moves. Yeah. Can I float one that is in a terrible movie, but that I think is another example of how character context and choreography all come together? One of my favorite fight scenes is the introduction of Crispin Glover's character in the first Charlie's Angels. And I say that with no, see, you're laughing at me, but I say that in seriousness. That's an amazing scene. It shows how the girls work together and they're having so much fun. And
well, he wins too, which is unexpected in the movie, doesn't he? Doesn't he get their hair?
They kind of retcon it a little bit in the second movie where you find out like why he's in love with Drew Barrymore and wants a lock of her hair, but they end up beating him off.
But that's all CG and
it's wire work. It's not CG. It's that whooping. I don't know if I'm
parkour.
No. It's wire work. It's the guy that did The Matrix. He choreographed the Charlie's Angels movies.
You like that movie way too much.
I do. I really do. I think all of the fight scenes in that are wonderful.
They're so artificial. That's character and context for you.
So the characters in that. Hold on. In terms of the internal fiction of the movie, the choreography is fantastic. The characters are just these awesome chicks who are having fun doing a goofy movie, and the context is that the context doesn't matter because the Charlie's Angels movies are just a loosely tied together series of basically music videos, some of which happen to be awesome fight scenes. So,
you are such a McGee apologist.
For the Charlie's Angels movies, I absolutely am. You're right.
Dude, come on.
All right, so
do you like both of the Charlie's Angels?
I do. I love both of them. And some people don't like the second one because it's a lot darker than the first one.
No, I like the second one more.
Yeah.
That's where the lack of interest and they're not caring, I kind of got it more. First one, I was resentful of it.
Maybe
I felt like Bill Murray did. I was like, yeah, what am I doing?
Maybe you should go back and see the first one. I don't know. Anyway, yeah, I'm definitely maybe not a McGee apologist, but certainly a Charlie's Angels apologist. So what did not quite make the list and was close for you guys?
Dina Ponjan. Godzilla versus Monster Zero, the one with three heads. No, wait, Gamera versus Ghidra.
Good. Okay.
Thank you.
Ghidra's the flying kind of pterodactyl-y dragon thing.
Also Megatron. Just kidding. Also Old Boy, that one scene where he's in the hallway. But that's one of those ones where you don't know who he's fighting, so it doesn't matter.
Like, that's another good one, though, Kelly Wand, for you can see that it's the actual actor. It's one take, you know, one shot.
And there's a lot of bludgeonings in it, which I like. Like, it looks like a lot of really painful punches to the face. I really like that. I like that movie.
Dingus, what didn't quite make it for you?
The one that I had the hardest time leaving off would be the fight between Jake LaMotta and Sugar Ray Robinson in Raging Bull.
It's very visceral.
Especially for your criteria, Dingus. Yeah. Wow.
My number one.
Way to blow it, Dingus.
No Star Wars on Dingus's list. I really thought I was going to trick him. In fact, I think that was my ulterior motive in this, and it didn't work.
Aha. Well done.
Epic fail.
So a friend of mine suggested the fight scene in Sword and the Stone. Do you guys know what this is? Do you remember this?
King Arthur, T.H. White.
The Disney film?
Yep.
What's the fight?
Well,
I try
to stay away from animation as well, but it's an animated film, yeah?
Yes, exactly. It's a cartoon. Right. You can call them cartoons. It's a fight between she said the names for who they were, and I forgot. Maybe it's like Arthur and Mrs. But it's two people with magical powers fighting each other by turning into progressively more powerful beasts.
Oh, that's good.
And they end up being dragons, but then Arthur turns into a mouse, and she puts her paw over the mouse and says, I got you. But then he turns into a virus and infects her, and she loses because her dragon gets sick and dies.
So it's a War of the Worlds kind of.
It can't be Arthur, then. It would have to be Morgan Le
Fay. Oh, Merlin.
Merlin,
right.
He knows what viruses are? Well, I guess he's... Yeah.
Well, and I recall she was describing to me the cartoon, and I was remembering, like, the escalating shapes and how they finally turn into dragons, and the way they represent the fact that it's a virus. I mean, I think he even explains, I turned into bacteria or whatever, is that her dragon gets all splotchy and sickly-looking, and then she dies. But it's this idea that what if you were super powerful and you could become anything, and those were your magical powers... What would happen in a fight there? You know, how would
he
you...
He becomes cancer.
Basically, yes. Right.
Oh, that's pretty good. That's a Disney movie, even. Yeah. Where cancer is the winning spell. that is good. That's definitely the best Disney fight, isn't it?
I don't know. What about Black Hole? Maximilian with those little twisty blades?
Vincent the Robot fights Maximilian.
There you go. Yeah, everybody remembers that one, right?
R2-D2 didn't fight much, except in Revenge of the Sith.
Didn't they give him lasers or something? He can shoot lasers, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure R2-D2 is armed now.
Yeah. Well, he could fly and shoot, but then he couldn't do either one against the Jawas.
Well, his memory was wiped.
No, C-3PO's was. His wasn't.
Yeah. All right, so that's for fights. Dingus, what do you got for us next week? Is it top three villains? I really hope it's top three villains.
No, it's just your three favorite movies.
Okay, The Losers.
All right, no, this is...
three random movies.
This is slightly related to one we've already done, but it's specific to... two moments in The Losers that made me think, what in the world is going on? And this isn't going to spoil anything, so we don't have to worry about that. But there were two moments early in The Losers where two characters, independent of each other in two different scenes, just decided to look at the camera.
What?
And break the fourth wall.
Hmm.
Jason Patrick does it, and Merle Haggard, Lynn Fling, Flam Flam Flam, the comedian and Max both have a line and look directly into the camera and break the fourth wall. And I have no idea why the hell that happens in this movie, and there's no payoff for it. And that type of convention has to be used properly in order for it to work. And when it isn't, when you just do it and just throw it away, it really takes me out of the movie. So we've already talked about voiceover in a previous 3x3. This is slightly separate. And I want you to talk about the best breaking of the fourth wall in a film, which works best for the film. You can use it in a scene or overall for the film and makes sense in the film. So best breaking of the fourth wall.
Is good. There a Burt Reynolds moratorium?
I'm not going to make any moratoriums other than there can be no lightsabers.
All right, good. So next week, join us for our 3x3, best breakings of the fourth wall. So rather than see Nightmare on Elm Street or Giveaway or Furry Vengeance, we have decided we are going to turn to DVD releases next week. So... for those of you listening, if you want to join us for a spoiler-laden discussion of a movie that I think is phenomenal, and I think we might be a little split for how some of us feel, we're going to be discussing 44-inch Chest, which just came out on DVD. It's a British movie directed by the writers of Sexy Beast, with Ray Winstone and some other awesome actors. Join us next week when we talk about that. And we bring you our 3x3 of best instances of breaking of the fourth wall. I am Tom Chick, and I am joined by Christian
Mrowski.
Ah, I almost had it, dang. And I am also here with Kelly Wand.
Kelly Dean Wand.
Corazón, mi corazón.
Also, Richard Kiel in EGA versus Ringo Starr in Caveman.